Welcome to Louisiana Considered. I'm Adam Voss. Just ahead on today's show, we'll hear why enrollment rates at Louisiana's community colleges are increasing despite a national downward trend. Plus, the 2023 Louisiana governor's race is heating up. We'll learn why a group of Louisiana's largest public affairs organizations have set out to educate both the voting public and the candidates about the state's most pressing issues. But first, a growing legal movement across the globe to grant natural entities like forests and rivers the same rights as humans is catching in the U.S. As Juan Pablo Ramirez Franco with the Ag and Water Desk reports, indigenous-led campaigns to recognize the legal rights of natural entities like wild rice, salmon, and lakes are setting the stage for a nascent movement on the Mississippi River.
The Mississippi River flows lazily today. Overhead on the Centennial Bridge connecting Illinois and Iowa and the Quad Cities, cars are cruising past and sometimes honking at a long line of environmentalists that say the river is alive.
The river have rights just like human rights. Our nature have rights, and it's up to us to preserve these rights.
That's Glenda Guster from Davenport, Iowa. She was among the 80 or so people to join the Great Plains Action Society's Walk for River Rights, the centerpiece of a three-day summit for Black and Indigenous organizers from across the Mississippi River Basin. According to Sakawa Snobis, the founder of the Indigenous Rights Organization, the goal is to build a river-wide coalition to rethink the legal framework they believe imperils life on and in the Mississippi River.
The earth is really suffering, and rights of nature would basically give personhood to the river, and it would allow us to have more power to keep it safe.
The idea is that natural entities, like rivers, trees, or wildlife, have the same rights as humans, and thus have legal standing in a court of law. The implications could be far-reaching. Companies could be taken to court for damaging the river or its ecosystems. That's exactly what happened in Tamaqua, a small town in Pennsylvania. Thomas Lindsay is a senior attorney at the Center for Democratic and Environmental Rights and drafted the document to get rights for the small borough.
It may be a radical concept, or it was 20 years ago, but we're rapidly coming to a place where without this kind of new system of environmental law that we're all kind of done.
Ultimately, locals were able to stop sewage sludge from being dumped in Tamaqua using the new ordinance. He adds that before the rights of nature movement made its way to the mainstream, it was born from the cosmologies of indigenous people that recognized the natural world as made up of living beings, not just resources and commodities. In 2008, Lindsay consulted the Ecuadorian government while it drafted its new constitution, the first in the world to ratify the rights of nature. In 2021, an Ecuadorian municipality appealed to those constitutional protections to overturn mining permits that they said violated the rights of nature of the endangered Los Cedros rainforest, and they won.
The work has spread to other countries and in the U.S. to about over three dozen municipalities at this point.
Lance Foster is a member of the Iowa Tribe of Kansas and Nebraska and a speaker at the Mississippi River Summit. He says that a couple years ago, the success of rights of nature in South America got his and other tribes thinking, why not us?
And we wondered, why hasn't the big rivers, the Missouri River and the Mississippi River, have those rights?
He says that his tribe and others have created a resolution for the rights of the Missouri River. They hope to use it to fight industrial-scale agriculture and deep mining operations. 2 years ago, in Minnesota, the White Earth Band of Ojibwe brought a suit against the Enbridge Corporation's Line 3 on behalf of the Manuman, or wild rice, and its right to exist and grow. And just a couple weeks ago, the city of Seattle settled a case with the Sauk-Suiattle Indian tribe over the claim that salmon had the right to spawn, among other rights. Foster says if corporations get legal rights in the U.S., why shouldn't rivers? After all, they were here far before humans.
Now, will we take that chance as a society? I'm dubious most days, but we have to keep trying. We have to keep going to the bitter end.
States like Idaho, Florida, and Ohio have moved to preemptively ban the possibility that nature or ecosystems can have legal standing. Even so, Foster says the rights of nature isn't as unthinkable as it once was. After all, children, women, Black and Indigenous people were once denied rights too. What's stopping the river? In the Quad Cities, I'm Juan Pablo Ramirez Franco.
This story is a product of the Mississippi River Basin Ag and Water Desk, a reporting network based at the University of Missouri School of Journalism. This is Louisiana Considered. The talk is already heating up in this fall's gubernatorial race here in Louisiana, with fundraising and full swing and attack ads already on the airwaves. And that's not the only election that will be demanding our attention. Multiple statewide offices will be on the ballot, not to mention the entire state legislature. A group of Louisiana's largest public affairs organizations are setting out to educate not just the voting public, but also the candidates themselves about the issues that are important to the state. To tell us about it, we have Barry Irwin, President and CEO of Council for a Better Louisiana. Welcome to the studio.
Well, thanks. Thanks for having me.
So tell me what it is you want the candidates to focus on when they're out there talking to constituents, when they're campaigning and debating.
Well, you know, our goal, our desire would be for them to talk about issues. We know that's going to be difficult because that is the nature of politics, probably, you know, since time immemorial. But I think what we're trying to do is we know there's going to be a lot of discussion about hot button issues, things that candidates want to talk about to kind of get voters riled up about this or riled up about that. We expect that. But what we would like to do is try and have kind of some foundational issues, grounding issues that we can keep coming back to that really are about moving the needle forward for Louisiana, for about looking at our future and trying to see where we are and how we can really move the needle on some of these indicators that, frankly, you know, none of us are too proud about.
And tell me about those issues.
Well, we've chosen four, and I would say at the outset, these aren't the only four issues that are important to Louisiana, but we do believe these are foundational and that if we make progress and address things in these areas, we will, you know, move the state forward. So for us, there's four issues, as I said, state fiscal policies, and that's kind of a broad thing from tax restructuring to dealing with constitutional issues, pension reform, all those types of things. Education, really at all levels, from early childhood education through K-12, higher ed, and workforce. Infrastructure, and certainly that's about roads and bridges, which we all know about the issues there, but also about things like broadband, the coast, water systems that we're finding out more and more, especially in our rural areas, are really in disrepair. And then also criminal justice, public safety.
Mm-hmm. Why these issues? They're certainly broad enough to keep you busy and encompass a lot of what people think needs improved in our state. But what are you hearing from Louisianans that makes you conclude that state finances, education, transportation, public safety, that those are the most important umbrella areas to focus on?
Well, I won't say they're just the most important, but a couple of things. For us, we have three organizations, ourselves, Cable, Public Affairs Research Council, and Committee of 100 for Economic Development. These are all areas where we feel like collectively we have some particular expertise in, that we've spent a lot of time on these and worked on. So we feel very comfortable talking about those, number one, collectively. Number two, I think if you look at some of these things and are trying to figure out how do we move up the state forward, either in rankings or really just in quality of life, you know, types of matters, these are things that can make a difference over the short term in some cases, but also certainly over the long term. And I mean, education to me is kind of foundational. We've got issues with poverty. We've got issues with health care, you know, incarceration, criminal justice, those things. But, you know, if we can address the education issue, which goes all the way through the workforce issue for adults, we can really do some you know, fundamental things to make Louisiana better. Kind of the same with the fiscal policies. People look at our state a lot and say, well, we're not competitive with other states. We point to Texas all the time, or Florida, or Tennessee, or somewhere like that. There are some things we can do with our tax structure, you know, in the relative short term that can actually, you know, make a difference in rankings, which can also make a difference in investment in the state. And finally, infrastructure. I think we all know that we're a bed of commerce of all types of transportation. Doing better on that infrastructure piece just makes us more competitive as well.
And tell me about the organizations involved. Cable, Council for Better Louisiana, C100, and PAR, Public Affairs Research Council. What stake do they have in this?
Well, we are kind of, I would say, like-minded organizations in a lot of ways. We're kind of looking, I think, towards the future. I think we're seen, well, certainly nonpartisan. We don't endorse candidates. We don't have any PACs, so we don't have any skin in the game in that regard. We really focus on issues. And we started this actually in 2019 for the first time. And I think that the sense was if we could bring together, you know, the strength of our three organizations, nonpartisan organizations, and use that as kind of a way to leverage, you know, access into the public discussion and debate about these issues and kind of keep grounding candidates as we can back on these things, that we can make a difference. And I think actually over the last 4 years on a couple of things we have.
You said since 2019. So in those past 4 years. What's been the result of your efforts? What have you seen?
Well, I think a couple of things. Number one, I think people don't always necessarily recognize this, but we passed some tax reform a couple of years ago that was really pretty significant in terms of dealing with our income tax and our corporate income taxes. They didn't really lower taxes that much in any regard like that, but they restructured them in a way that actually lowered the rates. We still get the same amount of money coming into the state, but they really did some structural change, and I think that's been very positive. I think on the education front, we've certainly been focusing on things like early reading and literacy, early childhood education, and we've seen some benefits and investments there. And obviously, too, in infrastructure, we didn't pass any new gasoline taxes or anything like that, but we have done a couple of things to redirect additional revenues into transportation. So those are three pretty big things right there.
We're speaking with Barry Irwin with Council for a Better Louisiana. We're talking about Reset Louisiana's Future, this year's effort from Cable, from PAR Louisiana, and C100 to help influence the quality of the dialogue ahead of this fall's elections. And from what I understand, Reset isn't putting forward any specific proposals for how to tackle these issues or advocating for any policy in particular. And I know everybody thinks of organizations going to the Capitol to influence, to lobby. What are some of the things you're doing and not doing?
Well, we do some advocacy at the Capitol. Our organizations kind of have different kind of playbook for that type of thing. But I think one of the things we are really trying to do that I think can be effective is trying to reach candidates that are running, particularly for the first time. We can reach incumbents. We know who they are. But we've got a lot of new people coming this time, not as many as before, but we've got at least 30-plus open or contested seats. That's a pretty good amount of change that's going to come to the legislature. And we're going to be working, we've already started actually, reaching out to candidates with kind of meetings with them, just kind of free-form policy briefings, just talking about policy, question and answer. We put together a pretty comprehensive kind of briefing book, which is available on our website. And then we want to just kind of get it out to the public at large, probably through social media and the mainstream media as well. But we just want to get those things out there and put these things more top of mind in the minds of voters.
Now, compare for me the rhetoric that you're hearing from the political sphere. Compare that to the kind of dialogue that you would hope to see to enable a productive conversation about what needs to be done and how candidates propose to do it. Can you compare what you're seeing and where you want to bring the dialogue?
Yeah, well, we're not naive. We've been around a little while, so we understand how political campaigns are going to go, and I don't think you can change that dynamic. But I think the thing that we can try to do is keep pushing these issues out there and keep asking the questions, how are you going to address infrastructure over the long term? We know early childhood is important and it can make a huge difference for kids throughout their life. What are you going to do to create a plan that's going to support that type of thing? In our case, we'll be partnering with Louisiana Public Broadcasting in a debate in the governor's race in September. We want to use that as a mechanism, too, to talk about issues and not just about the political machinations that go on. Those are among the things, but I think just having some of these issues, you know, grounded out there to draw people back to is helpful.
Barry Irwin, President and CEO of Council for a Better Louisiana. Thanks for being here today.
Oh, thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
From WRKF in Baton Rouge and WWNO in New Orleans, you're listening to Louisiana Considered. I'm Adam Voss. Louisiana is bucking a national trend that shows community college enrollment waning nationwide. Numbers in Louisiana are actually up. To help explain why and what that means for education of the state, we have Chandler LaBeouf, Governmental and Public Affairs Officer for the Louisiana Community and Technical College System. Welcome to Louisiana Considered.
Great. Thank you so much for having me this afternoon.
So do tell me, what do the numbers look like? How much is community college enrollment up or down nationwide? Up in Louisiana, how does that look?
Great. Well, that's a great question. And if you're looking and following the nationwide data and trends, it continues to talk about community college enrollment being down. And when we look at Louisiana's data this year, our enrollment is actually up compared to last year. We're able to look at that data of all of the students we serve across our state within our 12 community and technical colleges. And that's three different populations of students we serve. So students who are seeking adult basic education credential, a HISET high school diploma, students who are seeking the industry-based certifications traditionally in programs 16 weeks or less, or students who are seeking the associate's degree technical diploma level that could be up to 2 academic years. So again, we're over about 116,000 students this year compared to last year, which were around about 115,000.
And you're telling me about the numbers and how they're measured and what data counts and doesn't count. You have traditional enrollment, which people normally think of, but you have lots of other types of students that you serve included in that total number. Which students are the ones that are accounting for the largest numbers that community colleges are serving in Louisiana now?
So great question in regarding the population that may be driving those largest numbers. I will say students who are seeking the associate's degree in technical diplomas still remains to be one of our largest. But let's talk about the fastest growing. The fastest growing is those students who are seeking the industry-based certifications. The students who are entering programs 16 weeks or less, they're looking to upskill or reskill, and they're looking to enter into the workforce. And so that trend is growing in our system. That trend is also growing nationwide. And when you hear things about short-term Pell and funding for programs related to the short-term credential programs, we've been able to work to grow that population. A few measures like Reboot Louisiana and also the MJ Foster Promise program.
So tell me, what does it take to focus on that population of students who are coming in for these credentials, the ones that aren't the bread and butter of 2-year community college degrees? How are community colleges in the state pivoting to serve that population?
That's a great question. So when we talk about that being the non-traditional population, this is students who are coming from a employment and they may be choosing to upskill. They are single parents of multiple children working part-time, trying to attend school part-time or full-time. And so we've been able to create opportunity for these students in these programs where we're able to work with them to get them through the through the process in a quick time frame. And we're talking about programs that are high wage, high demand career opportunities. So an individual who may find themselves unemployed or underemployed is now going into a program like CDL or line worker, and they're completing that within maybe 6 weeks, maybe 16 weeks, and they're now making an average salary of $45,000 or $75,000 depending on the program. And so now they're able to contribute back to the economy. Now they're able to play into the economy and into the workforce space, and they're also able to provide for their family. And so that is really the opportunity that we see as part of our mission, is making sure we're not only providing the pathway for traditional students, but the pathway for non-traditional students as well.
What does that mean policy-wise as far as state government? Are community colleges poised for growth? How are they growing when it comes to these programs? Does it have to be approached from a different way? How do those resources change depending on these needs?
That's a really great question in terms of policy and advocating for those students who are seeking the short-term training programs. A lot of these short-term training programs do not qualify for federal Pell and financial aid. And so if they're seeking the traditional program, the technical diploma or associate's degree, they may apply for financial aid and receive federal Pell and other aid to support the program. But today, the non-credit programs do not seek and or receive the federal aid in regards to federal Pell. So you see the work that the Louisiana Community Technical College System has done over the last 2 years, where we've asked the state legislator to make the investments into Reboot Louisiana, Reboot Your Career Program, into the MJ Foster Promise Care Program, and to healthcare funding. And that was the opportunity for us to take individuals who are underemployed and maybe underskilled and to embrace the opportunity to seek the programs that allow them to become reskilled, but also the funding opportunities that are available to help offset the financial costs for these students, because otherwise they would have to pay out of pocket or get private loans. And so the opportunity to be able to support them through that policymaking of offsetting the expenses where aid is not available to those students has been key. So that is why the policy around this is so important, and we continue to advocate for it because it's creating pathways for Americans to be able to contribute to our middle class.
Is the policy changing as quickly as the needs change for the students that are engaging in these shorter programs? You mentioned, you know, funding is a barrier when the Pell Grant program, for instance, doesn't give you that grant.
That's a really important thing to note, is students and individuals every day, their needs change daily, weekly. And so, no, the needs are much more aggressive than the policy changes that occur that sometimes takes 2 years, 5 years, 10 years. And so we're still advocating daily on that short-term Pell at the federal level and in conversation, and it's not going to happen overnight. But the students' needs are changing overnight. And so we're trying to create partnerships as much as we can as well outside of the classroom. Things like food insecurity continues to be on the rise for our students. Things like unemployment and trying to find part-time jobs for students to be able to attend class but also be able to find the flexible employment to support their family while doing so continues sometimes be a barrier. We like to say that sometimes a student is one flat tire away from dropping out of school, right? Because maybe they don't have dollars to even pay for that one tire that needs repair. And so it's our job not only to advocate for the funding that allows them to seek the program, but it's our job to advocate for private-public partnerships and other resources.
So tell me about that. You mentioned public-private funding and how maybe the public side of it can be a little bit slower. Are more chancellors in the community college system going that direction to find that private funding to more quickly meet students' needs?
Yes, I would say that each of our chancellors from our 12 community technical colleges across our state are often having conversations with business and industry partners about students' needs and looking to create scholarship opportunities, looking to create endowments, looking to partner to create things like food and resource pantries, whether it's technology related or school supply related. And a lot of that results in scholarships, and a lot of it results in making investments into the institution and allowing the institution to use that resource where their highest priority need may be. And some of that is maybe supplying students with books and supplies and laptops as needed, because they may not have the resource to access the work online through the computer. And also broadband and internet continues to be a conversation at the forefront.
What do you see coming next? What's on the horizon for community colleges in Louisiana?
Well, two things I'd like to highlight today is, one, we're continuing to focus on making sure that our colleges have the resources they need to serve the students. And so it's not about getting the students in the door. It's about making sure that we can keep the student on their track of their academic and workforce journey, and that we're solving their barriers that may exist when they come into our institutions. And then the second thing we're continuing to advocate is around the short-term Pell, the opportunity that those funds would become available.
Chandler LaBeouf, Government and Public Affairs Officer for the Louisiana Community and Technical College System. Thank you for your time today.
Great. Thank you so much. I really enjoyed having this time with you.
This is Louisiana Considered. I'm Adam Voss. It's been a year since the Supreme Court overturned Roe v. Wade, and with it, federal protections for abortion. At what point did you realize that things have changed? This is a call out for our listeners. Email a voice memo with your name, where you're from, and your answers to that question to GulfStatesNewsroom@gmail.com, or give us a call at 205-538-2213. That's GulfStatesNewsroom@gmail.com or area code 205-538-2213. That's Louisiana Considered on a Wednesday. Thanks to our guests today, Juan Pablo Ramirez-Franco, reporting from the Quad Cities in Iowa and Illinois, just a little ways up the river, Barry Irwin from Council for Better Louisiana, and Chandler LaBeouf from the Louisiana Community and Technical College System. Our managing producer is Lana Schreiber, and our digital editor is Caitlin Umholtz. Our engineers are Garrett Pittman and Aubrey Purcell. You can catch Louisiana Considered Monday through Fridays on this station at noon and 7:30 p.m. Thanks for listening.
Major support for Louisiana Considered provided by Rouse's Markets, a Louisiana shopping experience, with additional support from Tulane School of Public Health.